From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll have highlights from our recent Across the Divide panel on immigration. We spoke with immigrant and very recent Marquette graduate Valeria Navarro-Villegas.
I see myself with one foot here and one foot there. I feel like I don't belong here and I don't belong in Mexico anymore. I live in two worlds, and I do see the difference that my education has brought me.
Christopher Schmeling, the Racine County Sheriff, was also on the panel.
I took an oath, and I follow the rules. Oftentimes people don't like it, but I have to follow the rules. Can you imagine what it would be like at my roll call in front of my deputies if I tell them, all right, men and women, today we're not going to enforce the law on this?
And immigration lawyer Jose Olivieri participated as well.
I think our immigration system is a mess. It doesn't meet the needs of our employers. And that is the full range of employers.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Recently, WUWM's Lake Effect and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel hosted an Across the Divide event at Carroll College in Waukesha. It was called New Realities for Immigrants. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke was joined on stage by Journal Sentinel reporter Mary Spacuzza to host the discussion. Our Across the Divide series has one very fundamental goal. We want to talk about current issues in a civilized way, while recognizing that reasonable people might still disagree at the end of the night. The important thing is that they will have heard each other speaking. There has been no shortage of hyperbole in the current debate over immigration policy. Hopefully, the personal perspectives that each of our panelists brought to this event will help us shift from the hyperbolic to an on-the-ground conversation. With that in mind, Mary Spacuzza began by introducing the first panelist.
We're going to start with Valeria Navarro-Villegas, who is an immigrant from the Mexican city of León and a very recent graduate of Marquette University, I think yesterday. Yes. Congratulations. Can you tell us a little bit more about your story and where you see yourself in the context of the current immigration debate?
Hello, everyone. I was born in Mexico, in León, Guanajuato, and when I was 5 years old, my dad immigrated to the U.S. Without telling my mom or saying goodbye. So months went by without us knowing where my father was. It was a decision he took by himself. My mother didn't want to leave her family in Mexico, didn't want to move here. She was happy where we were, but we were struggling economically. And so after months, my dad called my grandparents' house, and eventually my mother was able to speak to my dad. My dad kept on sending money back home to keep us, with food on our table and clothing on our backs. And years went by, and my mother wasn't able to raise three girls by herself. So she took the decision to bring us here to reunite us with our father. And so we came to Milwaukee on May 22nd, 2000, exactly 17 years ago. So it's a big day for me today. And I see myself in the situation where I understand that it was an illegal decision to just cross the border. But I also see my parents' struggles, and I remember living in the poverty that we experienced. Although I was a very happy little girl, food we had enough, but like my mom used to always tell us, we don't have a messy house because we only have one pair of shoes each. She brought us here in hopes that education was gonna liberate us from those hardships, and she didn't want us to have a life that she had. She was married at 21. She had me at 22. By the time she was 28, she had the three of us with not enough money to keep a family moving forward. So she pushed and pushed, and eventually, I got to college. In 2011, I started at Marquette University. I had a lot of struggles getting through college. It was economically hard and emotionally and psychologically with how our state is. But I finished yesterday. And my parents' sacrifices and dreams became a reality as I crossed the stage last night. And I see myself with one foot here and one foot there. I feel like I don't belong here and I don't belong in Mexico anymore. I live in two worlds, and I do see the difference that my education has brought me. I've been able to obtain a full-time and a part-time, been able to buy my own car at a very young age compared to my parents. I've been able to help my parents financially. I've been able to help my sisters get to college. We're all college enrolled, even though we're all undocumented. And it's a hard situation to be in. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next guest is Christopher Schmeling, who has served as sheriff of Racine County since he was elected in the fall of 2010. Welcome, and let me ask where you see yourself and your department in the current immigration debate.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite here. My commentary tonight, just to do a little housekeeping, does not reflect anything from the Waukesha County Sheriff's Office or any law enforcement agency there. I'm from Racine County, naturally. I'm pleased to be here tonight. I do have an opinion on a lot of matters, especially as it pertains to law enforcement. But a little bit about myself. I began my career at 22 years old, right out of college, working at the Lake County Sheriff's Department in Waukegan, Illinois. I worked there as a correctional officer. I wanted to get on the street. That's what I went to school for. I wanted to get out and interact with the community and do some good. So I applied to Kenosha, that was my hometown, and Racine. And anyone who's ever applied to law enforcement knows that you have to take the first job you get because they're just really hard to get into. By the time you get through the background checks and psychological exams and a multitude of interviews, you tend to grab the first agency that will hire you. Racine hired me. So I started my career working again in the Racine County Jail. Then I worked undercover narcotics, so it was a very eye-opening experience. So I worked in that for a period of time, and then I worked on a patrol division. I worked investigations, and that was where my heart really was. For 10 years, I worked investigations, but working a lot of crimes against children, domestic violence task force. I'm a strong member of that. NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. I'm a Wisconsin board member. Those are very important things to me, dealing with people with mental health issues, dealing with women with domestic violence, and naturally dealing with children who find themselves in abusive households. I decided to run for sheriff. I come from a big family, big Catholic family of nine. I'm the youngest of nine. And I talked about the things I've done in my career and my upbringing and what I would do for my community. I'm now in my second term, and next year I'm looking into my third term. I'm very proud to be the Racine Sheriff. But to answer your question, where do I see myself, where do I see my agency going? I'm all about law and order. I'm a rule follower. I took an oath, and I follow the rules. Oftentimes people don't like it, but I have to follow the rules. Can you imagine what it would be like at my roll call in front of my deputies? I have 240 law enforcement professionals that work for me. Imagine what that would be like in the roll call room if I tell them, all right, men and women, today we're not going to enforce the law on this. We're going to enforce the law on that. We just can't do it that way, and it just doesn't make sense. I'm just as disturbed about the things that are going on, and we talk about people coming out of the shadows. I know that there are children in abusive families that go unreported simply because they have families that are undocumented. They don't want, maybe there's an immigration warrant for them and they don't want to call us. So I know that there are crimes that are going on that we simply aren't known about for that very reason. I'm looking to the community. I'm looking to our federal government to come up with some solutions because it puts law enforcement, to answer your question, in a very, very awkward position. And right now, law enforcement in communities, whether it's about immigration, whether it's about the drug issues, gangs, use of force, there's a lot of debates going on right now in our arena. So this is just another piece of that puzzle that we're trying to sort out as each and every one of you are. But thank you.
Our third member of the panel is Jose Olivieri, who's founder and co-chair of Michael Best's Immigration Law Practice. Welcome, and can you share a little bit about your perspective on and where you see yourself in the current immigration debate?
Sure. I'm originally from Puerto Rico. Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens by birth. So I was part of the wave of Puerto Ricans that went from Puerto Rico to New York and back to Puerto Rico, back and forth over the years. I came to Wisconsin right after graduating from high school in Puerto Rico to attend Carroll. So I've got the sort of sense of coming from another place. On the other hand, pretty quickly after I was here, after a few years, I developed an identity that was beyond Puerto Rican and basically sort of connected to this notion of Latin American, Latino, Hispanic. So that became something I was interested in. I became interested in the immigration issue as a public policy issue sort of related to that. My first summer, in between first and second year of law school, my job was working with Legal Action Wisconsin, which provided legal services to the poor. In my situation, was exclusively in immigration. That's how I started learning about the law. I After I graduated from law school, I joined the firm that I'm with. Our firm didn't do any immigration work. I was interested in it, so I took on some asylum cases, some defensive deportation cases, sort of learned a little bit more about it. But then I also realized we had many, many, many clients in the firm that needed immigration help in terms of employment immigration. So our practice is essentially exclusively around employment. So my work is around facilitating people coming into the United States, do a little bit of also getting into other countries along the way too. But that sort of flow of people from one country to the other is what I do on a regular basis.
This is probably a question for both you and for Sheriff Schmeling. Both of your jobs at some level involve basically interpreting what the federal government is saying about immigration policy. Do you think, and maybe this is an unfair question, but do you think the dictates that you're handed do justice to the nuances of immigration as you see it playing out on the ground in your respective roles?
I'll go first if you don't mind. I just want to make something clear. It's from a street perspective, a boots on the ground, there are a lot of things that are going on. These directives that we speak about, in terms of what has changed what we do and how we do business on a day-to-day basis, when we do a traffic stop, as an example, we run people. What does that mean? I think a lot of folks in our community, and perhaps here as well, feel that there's this magic immigration button in our squad cars, that we can hit that button and immediately tell whether or not you're here legally or not. That is not the case. Now, if that said, if there is a warrant for the person, and once in a while we get a detainer from immigration, that is all we know about that. They want this person for whatever reason it may be. We handle that as we would any other detainer, a detainer out of Arizona, detainer from the federal authorities. That person gets brought to the jail, and then the immigration would be contacted, as an example. They have not given us any directives to how to handle that differently. I know they are looking for deputies or officers to be trained in immigration laws. My deputies wouldn't know the wiser at this point in terms of how to handle that any differently than how they handle any other citizen in terms of a traffic stop or any other citizen encounter that we handle.
If I could follow up for just a moment, because in your introductory remarks, you said you're pretty sure that there are probably people out there that aren't reporting things like domestic abuse cases. When someone makes a call like that, how does immigration and the status of a potential immigrant enter the process for a deputy who might go on scene to investigate something?
Well, in the other law enforcement encounter, we train our staff, very much like any city police officer, we ask for identification, and we run that person through those areas of our operation. If immigration has a want or a detainer for them, it's noted at that time. But we don't do any, and there's no other follow-up that we can do. We don't have a link into the immigration database, if you will. It's what's known in the system is what's known in the system. Again, we're responding to calls 24/7. This is not a 9-to-5 job. It's 2 in the morning and we're stopping people and talking to people, having these interactions. People call us for help and we're trying to learn who we're dealing with so we can properly document those types of things. Again, sitting on a domestic violence task force in Racine County, I hear of stories where people have said they didn't call for those reasons, that they didn't call because a family member in that household may have been wanted by immigration authorities, so that crime, that safety, public safety issue went unreported. So I know that does exist, and I'm certain it exists here in Waukesha if it's happening in Racine.
And as the sheriff, what would you recommend to someone who's in that situation who might be here illegally or who might have family members who are in that predicament?
Naturally, it's easy for me to say to come forward. I'm not in that situation. My heart goes out to anyone who finds themselves in that situation. But to get out of an abusive relationship, a child that's being molested, they need to come forward. I know there are consequences to coming forward. I understand that. And my heart goes out to them. But to allow that to continue, it just can't happen. So I would ask them to come forward.
And this actually follows up on that. I think I'll send it to Valeria first, maybe. But we've been reading about recent numbers of increasing arrests of immigrants in the country illegally. I think it was a 32% increase. And there are different theories about whether that's making the country safer or whether it's making it less safe in examples of maybe a domestic violence victim not wanting to come forward because they're here illegally or their children are here illegally. Do you feel like the current crackdown on immigration is increasing public safety or raising more problems?
I don't know if it's necessarily fixing anything. I think it's causing people to be more afraid to report a crime that's done to them by a citizen. I can personally testify to that. I was raped in 2014, and my family didn't want to report the rape. And my mother was really afraid of going to the police, of calling the police, of having the police in our house, of having to go to the courtroom. So I dealt with it by myself, because I was under DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and I felt protected enough to come forward. But for individuals like my parents, if I hadn't been around, they would have never reported anything like that. And it just causes more fear. And I don't think it's solving the crimes. I think it's making people who are undocumented being victimized by citizens and residents keep quiet even more.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We will take a short break and then return with more of our recent Across the Divide panel discussion on immigration. You are listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Let's get back to our Across the Divide panel discussion on immigration. It was recorded last week at Carroll College in Waukesha. Panelists included Mexican immigrant and recent Marquette graduate Valeria Navarro-Villegas, Racine County Sheriff Christopher Schmeling, and the founder of Michael Best's immigration law practice, Jose Olivieri. They joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Mary Spacuzza on stage, and Jose Olivieri leads off this part of the discussion.
I think our immigration system is a mess at this point. It doesn't meet the needs of our employers, and that is the full range of employers. In Wisconsin, for example, our dairy farmers are desperately looking for employees. A significant portion of the employees that work in dairy farms in Wisconsin are undocumented. And it's a great deal of uncertainty for the employer side. We have a law in the United States that allows people to come in if they're professionals, and all of those visas for the whole year are used up in one day. For the whole year, they're all used up in one day. We have, talking about situations where you have a U.S. citizen brother who wants to petition for their brother who lives in Mexico, 10 years plus. Now, I don't know about your brother, but my brother would not wait 10 years. He'd just come across the border. So we have we have 11 million people in the United States, and we don't know who they are. So our system as a whole is a mess. We need to deal with it. We need to come up with ways of resolving, coming up with reform. It's a debate that's going to have to be resolved at some point. But at this particular point, what we have is a mess.
Sheriff Schmeling, I'm curious, and you don't need to give me numbers or anything, but how often does immigration status come up in the business of the Racine County Sheriff's Office, the kind of day-to-day work that you and your deputies do?
It's rare that it would come up, and you would think it would be more, given the hot topic we've been discussing as a country as a whole, is not often. I would say probably 12 to 15 times a year approximately we deal with a situation like that. We don't ignore that. They're brought to the Racine County Jail. Sometimes they already have other charges, thus the interaction we had with them, and they have to deal with that immigration. Now, they don't report back to us and tell us the status. We simply notify them. They will come to the jail, either pick them up, interview them, or do whatever it is they do, but they don't follow back up with some sort of disposition with us. So it's not as often as you would think. Again, and that partly could be because, folks don't call us because of that fear.
Do you feel a responsibility to secure the safety of people regardless of their immigration status?
Well, absolutely. I rose my hand and took an oath to protect everyone within my community, any visitors, irrespective of their race, religion, immigration status. That is the least of our worries at this point. I'm about public safety and enforcing the law as we know it.
I think we're going to switch and add in some audience questions at this time.
Erin, do you have one from internet land, or do you want to?
Yeah, we have a couple. I can ask one, and then we can go to some audience questions.
We have one in the front as well. So
back in. This one came early in the discussion. Valeria, how did you fund your college education?
I received an Urban Scholars scholarship. It's a full tuition scholarship for academic base and my community service. So I had a 3.9 in high school, but I earned that 3.9 knowing that that was my only way to get to college. And so when I applied to Marquette University, I applied for this private scholarship that was granted to me. I was one of the 10 individuals out of the 1,000 students.
Thank you. My name is David Sartori. I am the 8th District Supervisor of the Milwaukee County Board. This issue really is very conflicting to me. I agree so much with the Sheriff of Racine County. I mean, we are a nation of laws. We also are a nation of compassion. I take great personal pride in the fact that I have Italian grandparents and German grandparents. They came to this country over a century ago. They went to Ellis Island. They did things the legal way. They had sponsors. They traveled to Wisconsin. And I agree with the attorney. Our immigration system, regardless of which position you take, is broken. It is the responsibility of Congress, not the Racine Sheriff's Department. I, as an elected Milwaukee County official, will not have Milwaukee County Sheriff's deputies or jailers going on witch hunts, rounding up non-residents. But if, in the normal course of law enforcement, they come into contact with someone who has a detainer, someone who has a warrant, that's a totally different situation.
Sir, to your point, this is a federal issue. I'm looking to the federal government to come up with a solution. I vote just like every one of you do. I look to our Congress, I look to our elected officials for guidance. I look for them to fix this problem that they have been kicking that can down the road for years, rather than shoving it down the throats of law enforcement. I'm looking for some direction from them. But I can assure you that as a law enforcement leader in our community, it is law enforcement's responsibility. And no offense, sir, but it's not a county board member. It's not the mayors of cities. I've seen our mayor announce that we're a sanctuary city, and I don't know where they get that authority from, but that is not the case. Who claims that to be a sanctuary city? I know Racine has been talked about as a sanctuary city, and we have not changed business since I've been there for 22 years. We enforce the law. And I'd like to think that other sheriffs would agree. We are the chief law enforcement officers in our county. We enforce the law. But we need help from the federal government to do that. I'm looking for a solution just like everyone else in this room, for those reasons that we outlined.
At one point, you really got into the United States if you presented yourself. There were a few things that limited people coming in, but essentially you presented yourself, you got in. Now, that has changed dramatically over the last 100 years. Much more complex system to get into the United States. And in fact, we've made some decisions in the last 30 years or so that actually have made it very difficult to go from an undocumented or illegal status to a legal status. What we've done is we've, through our policy decisions, we've created a situation where you can't, no matter how much you try, move from illegal to legal. It just, you can't do it. There's no mechanism in place. We made that decision as a country. Now, that's caused some problems for us. The other thing that I wanted to say was on the issue of the rule of law, because I think that is a very interesting issue and one that I worry about as I think about this issue. But I do think that in law, when you think about the immigration status, sort of like the death penalty of immigration is deportation, essentially removing someone from the country. So my view is, okay, if people have violated the law, we should come up with remedies. We should come up with sanctions that are a little bit more humane, aren't the death penalty of immigration, but come to a situation where you could correct. Maybe you would serve in the sense of paying some fines, doing some things. And that used to be the law in the United States. We used to have these mechanisms where we could legalize. We have none today. We've really cut it off. So I think you can act consistent as a country with the rule of law, but you don't have to have the rule of law mean that anybody that's in here illegally gets deported no matter what, no matter the circumstances.
More of our Across the Divide panel discussion on immigration continues when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thank you. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We continue now with our Across the Divide panel discussion on immigration. It was recorded last week at Carroll College in Waukesha with panelists Valeria Navarro-Villegas, Christopher Schmeling, and Jose Olivieri. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Mary Spicuzza and Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke co-hosted the onstage event.
Valeria, I guess for people who aren't familiar, what did it take to accomplish your status?
Well, I was undocumented until I was 19. It was my sophomore year at Marquette University, and I was doing an internship through the Kleshka government program, and I was placed through Voces de la Frontera. And I was doing my internship that summer, and it just happened out of nowhere. I remember writing letters to former President Obama how much it would have meant to me to be able to work and to study even more. I wanted to travel. I wanted to hold positions, internships in government or in agencies that required my Social Security. I was studying pre-med, and I couldn't even volunteer at a hospital because I wouldn't be able to pass my background check. You know, I had no record. And it just like really was kind of like tying my hands. And so when deferred action for childhood arrivals passed through the Obama administration, I was able to receive a work permit. I'm not legally here. It expires every 2 years. So it's a work permit that allows me to get Social Security to apply for a driver's license and to be able to use it for work. And so every 6 months before it expires, I pay a fine, I pay a lawyer, and I get it renewed before it expires so I can keep my employment. I recently renewed it this March, and thus I was able to start at the Milwaukee County Jail. Believe it or not, I'm working there. It's an irony. I've placed myself in very ironic situations. I studied in Washington, D.C. I walked through the buildings of the House of Representatives, this rubbing shoulders with all the senators, and I couldn't believe that I was undocumented, living a life that people didn't want me to have.
Do we have any more audience questions or questions from the internet?
We do have one from the internet. Sheriff, I think you can answer this one pretty quickly. Earlier, you were talking about what would happen if you pulled over somebody and started running their documentation. One person wants to know, would your deputies arrest a person who only had an outstanding ICE detainer and not a warrant outstanding? Meaning, a detainer is a request from Immigration and Customs Enforcement and is not a warrant from a judge. So what exactly would prompt the taking that person into custody?
Providing it's a lawful detainer, we'll take that person into custody, and we can verify it. In that case, we report back to our dispatch center. They're the ones who would inform us of that, obviously. And in that particular case, they would confirm with whoever issued that detainer and if it was actually a legitimate detainer, and my deputies would take that person into custody.
Okay, thanks. Let's go to this side of the room because I don't think anyone's had a chance to ask over here.
Hello. First, I just wanted to congratulate you, Valeria, for graduating from school. That's incredible. And just thank you for sharing your story with us. But my question is for the sheriff, and I just wanted you to clarify, are you planning on implementing the 287G program? And if, like, yes or no, what is your reasoning behind it?
Well, as I mentioned at my introduction, the citizens of Racine County elected me to enforce the laws of the community in which they live in. I am not planning on implementing that because I simply don't have the staffing for that.
And Jose Olivieri, maybe you can clear this up for us. I wonder if there's a semantic issue that a lawyer might help with. Is 287G a law or is it a directive? Is there a difference between the two? I mean,
there's a statute. It's a law. It's a law, and it does require that there be agreements with local governments in order to effectuate the policy contained in the law.
So to that end, there's not a current agreement with the Racine County Sheriff's Office, for example?
There's not an agreement currently.
Are there more questions?
Okay, both of you gentlemen said that it's a mess. And at first I wasn't really getting, what's a mess? And then, Jose, you kind of explained the mess is there's no reasonable process to deal with it, which is really kind of insane when you think about it, that something that should be able to be, you know, dealt with hasn't been for this long. It's obvious that The large majority of even the undocumented are lawful people. And it's also obvious that we need those people in this country to milk cows, to do landscaping work, to do any number of jobs like that that other people don't seem to want to do. So we got a president that's pushing, we got to drive up growth, Well, if you don't have a labor supply, that's not going to happen. So I guess for me it's hard to understand. There seems to be just some common sense that could be put into solving this problem, and yet we don't seem to be getting anywhere with it. What is a reasonable way to address this?
To start off, I was 7 when I crossed the border. We took a flight to Tijuana, and from Tijuana we took a megabus that drove us from Tijuana to Nogales, Sonora. And from Nogales, Sonora, we crossed the border to Nogales, Arizona. It was so traumatizing that I don't remember everything. I only have flashbacks. I remember it was bright and early, like 8 o'clock in the morning. We ran under a fence. The coyote had dug a fence out, and he took all of our belongings and threw them to a ditch. And I remember feeling that moment, like it hit me, like I'm leaving everything behind. I had brought with me my favorite toy and, I don't know, like photos of my grandparents. So we ran and we ran straight to the other side, and we went to McDonald's where there is a woman waiting for us to cross us. And I remember thinking, like, she was a woman, you know, she's going to be nice to us because it was my mother and my sister's. But as soon as we got into her really nice car, she had a red sports car. She had guns right in the middle of the compartment, and she told us, you better not be quiet or you're going to, you know, get shot. And my sister was 2 years old, and she started crying. And my sister, who was 5, you know, they panicked, and I just was in awe. I couldn't speak. And we drove off, and I don't remember anything. I think I was traumatized to see, like, the insensitivity of a woman who saw other women trying to get better, a better life, who just didn't care. We were money signs. So eventually we got to California, you know, with men escorting us with guns, who didn't turn us over to our family until they counted all the money in cash at a gas station. And as soon as they had all the money, just picked us up like sacks of potatoes and just threw us into the car that my uncle was waiting, he was waiting there. And I just couldn't believe how they were treating us, especially my little 2-year-old sister, who was not going to do anything or could run anywhere. But to answer the question, I feel that to solve the problem, we have to start addressing at least to the individuals like myself, who the many of dreamers who want to study, who are capable of becoming doctors, lawyers. You know, we have the capacity to do so much. We're smart enough to know 2 languages. We're smart enough to be engineers. We're smart enough to do more than just landscaping and cleaning houses. I'm not embarrassed to say that I cleaned houses since I was 12 years old with my mother. And I cleaned houses for my classmates. And that's humiliating. But it was a sacrifice that we had to do in order for us to be able to attend university. And I think giving students and young children who, you know, are innocent the path to citizenship is a start. You know, my parents, I don't know how they would be able to be legalized, but they also have so much to offer. My dad's a construction worker. He's been building your homes the 17 years that he's been here. My mom has been cleaning the houses for women who don't have the time because they're so busy being lawyers and accountants. They all need us in some sort of way. I mean, we're irreplaceable. If we leave, you won't have me as an interpreter, as a Milwaukee County jail screener, as a investigator at my Centuna and Coffee law firm, as your manager at Pete's Food Market. I've held so many important positions. I mean, I know there's people who to replace us, but not at the level that we are able to extend our capacity. I can communicate in 2 languages. I've tried learning French. Like, we are unstoppable.
We'll take one last break and then return with the conclusion of our Across the Divide panel discussion on immigration. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We conclude our Across the Divide panel discussion on immigration now. It was recorded last week at Carroll College in Waukesha. Panelists included Mexican immigrant and recent Marquette graduate Valeria Navarro-Villegas, Racine County Sheriff Christopher Schmeling, and the founder of Michael Best's immigration law practice, Jose Olivieri. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Mary Spicuzza and Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke co-hosted the event, and we begin this segment with a question from the studio audience.
I'd like to know if any of you are aware of a situation where, let's say, someone with lack of opportunity comes to the U.S. and with their spouse or their partner, and they have a family while in the U.S. They've maybe accumulated some money in an account, and somehow ICE comes to their door, and they will be deported, or they are deported, and their children are citizens of the United States. What happens to those children? What would those parents do in that case where they're torn from their family?
Well, you know, one is to try to have a family member or someone else assigned to take care of the children. And if not, it really would be social services that would take care of the children. This happens periodically where the parents are deported or one parent is deported and they're still in their U.S. citizen children. Government really can't deport the children. On occasion, the whole family will go together, and that'll be an accommodation it's made. But if not, you've got to designate somebody or social services will take care of it. Typically, those children will be citizens of that country also through their parents. So even though they were born here and they're U.S. citizens, they derive citizenship in their parents' country because they're born of the parents.
I'd like to thank Valeria for her telling her story. And also, I feel that immigrants shouldn't always be kept at a servitude level. I feel like they should have the opportunity to excel and be more than just a house cleaner. And it bothers me that, to some degree, I often hear we need the people to those 11 million to clean our houses and things like that. We actually need to elevate them, give them an opportunity. I personally believe if there's 11 million illegal immigrants, we have 320 million citizens. There is such thing as a voluntary departure bond that could be extended to 3 years. That voluntary departure bond could then have a bondholder who signs that bond and is obligated to ensure that that immigrant meets our laws, becomes integrated into our society, understands our culture, values, and norms, and then we don't have to hire another 10,000 immigration agents. So I do believe that instead of the sheriff here having to train 10 officers on something that they're truly not going to understand because it's too complicated, it's not what they really are here to do. But we do have plenty of citizens that would sign a bond. That bond would then be held by that citizen who would then be responsible to check on that individual because the values and norms and proper treatment of the immigrant is the only way they're going to become part of our society.
It really is no significant solution to deal with the issue. I mean, you may have individual situations where a bond would be a vehicle to allow someone to be in society, but it's not really an overall solution.
You know, last year we sat by and watched the TV, and we watched over a dozen people who wanted to be our president of the United States. Not a single one of them have a solution to this issue. And your story is just horrific, and I'm sorry you had to, you know, experience that. And there's some people that don't survive that. There's human trafficking rolled into that type of thing. It would be nice if there was a solution, again, from our top-level elected officials so that those who want to enter our country can do so legally, that they don't have to hire a coyote, hire people with guns in their car, and scurry underneath a fence and look over your shoulder every day that you're in this country.
Hi. This question is directed to Valeria. You were talking about how you have to renew your DACA forms every 2 years.
Yes.
Does that just go on indefinitely for the rest of your life? Or, you know, at what point do you become a citizen? How does that work?
There's no point. It'll never come. And it's something that will only be active as long as the president keeps it. He can revoke, maybe could revoke that, you know, law or that ability to obtain employment or that authorization. It's a work authorization permit specifically targeting Dreamers. And it could go any day, and it could stay as long as we let it be, but it'll never move us anywhere. And I think about it as if, like, I had a cut that needed stitches, but we put a Band-Aid on it. And it'll just keep on bleeding forever because it's not the real solution. It's just a Band-Aid, and it's not the stitches that we need.
One of the things I think that has been an important part of the history of the United States is our commitment has been to assimilate those that come to the United States. In many parts of Europe, their policy has actually been the contrary. It's very difficult to become a citizen of many countries. In the United States, we have actually had a policy that encourages the idea of becoming citizens, of becoming part legally part of the society. And that's one of the challenges we have right now. We're sort of acting sort of contrary to what our history has been in terms of assimilating. And we have a powerful assimilation engine in this country. I mean, a country in which people quickly become connected to the society. That's what we've done. We've created this, but right now we're in a situation where we've got a big group of people in the United States, and we haven't decided how we want to assimilate them. And this legal issue has really become a problem for us, and we have people like Valeria who, at this point, they look forward. There's no solution. Even though she may have come when she was 7 years old, she wasn't the one who decided, hey, let's go to the United States. She came along. Her family brought her. But again, it's contrary to how we typically have looked at things, where we want people to become Americans. I mean, essentially, that's what we want. And we've got systems in place to do it. But here we've got this situation where we're really not able to deal with it effectively.
We've got three more questions back here. We might be able to take one more, but if not, then I know our panelists can stay for a few minutes afterwards if you've got individual questions you want to pose to them. So we'll start over here.
This question was for Jose, and you had mentioned earlier and touched on briefly some of the mechanisms that were in place earlier when you had started practicing law, and you had said they had disappeared and there's nothing left. So what were those mechanisms? Why were they taken away, and what would it help if they were brought back?
Well, I think they would help if they were brought back. There were situations where people were here undocumented, and you could, if, for example, an employer, which is the situation I'm involved in, an employer could petition for someone. The person in that situation would generally have to leave the United States but then came back in with a visa that was related to employment. That's essentially impossible today to do. Once you've been here more than 6 months, you've got prohibitions for 3 years. If you've been here for a year, it's 10 years that you can't get back into the United States. So you really, there's no mechanism to accomplish that. So that's one thing I think, and again, we decided that in the mid-90s. We decided it was a compromise with regard to immigration reform. Again, it was trying to get at the whole issue of enforcement, and the decision was that we were going to essentially, you know, have this as part of our punishment for having come in and stayed. So I think things like that would help. It isn't the entire solution, but you know, we had a pretty comprehensive solution just a few years ago in the Congress, and it got really close to passing. It didn't happen. Probably a difficult scenario today. I think you're going to have to sort of pick issues. For example, I think the Dreamers issue, there might be a solution that's more than just a two-year. There might be a path, ultimately, and I think even the Trump administration is not closing the door to the idea of some solution that isn't just giving people two-year extensions. So we'll see. Maybe that's one issue that gets resolved along the way.
Thank you. I think the thing I've heard tonight is all three of you have agreements that this immigration system is a problem that has to be fixed. I've heard unanimity on that up there tonight. And I'm interested in, if you had those solutions in mind, I understand you're not the federal government, but all politics is local, and you guys are local. So starting with you, Jose, and then just moving over, what would be your top three? Top three, just quickly.
Well, top three, one, I'd deal with the Dreamers. I mean, again, it's maybe a million-something people, but I think it's an important group. It's a group in which even on the issue of rule of law, these are people that were innocent. They had really no, they were brought here. So I think that's one issue we should deal with and deal with it quickly. I do think that there's a special relationship with Canada and Mexico in terms of borders. I mean, we have to recognize the historic connection between the southern part of the United States and Mexico, and our immigration policy has to sort of recognize that.
How about you, Chris, from a law enforcement standpoint?
Well, from a law enforcement standpoint, I mean, this goes beyond immigration for me. When we talk about securing borders, we're looking at the influx of drugs that are coming into our community, and it just doesn't stay on those neighboring states. We're seeing a huge, huge epidemic in our communities, and Waukesha is no different. A spike in overdoses, children experimenting with drugs for the first time, and finding themselves, families are attending funerals for young people. So for securing the borders, I think, is paramount, not just for the drugs, but also for illegal immigrants coming into our country. We're bringing these types of illegal substances in. But fixing that problem, having our federal, holding the hands of our elected officials to the fire to fix the problem that they have been ignoring for many, many years. And creating some kind of pathway for individuals like yourself who have demonstrated clearly to this country that they can do a great job here, they're productive, and lead productive lives, and they follow the rules of our land, the laws that we all live by. My position is very, very self-centered, and that is holding true to my oath of office, and that is enforcing the laws, and doing so impartially and fairly.
And Valeria, just your top three quickly.
I mean, I agree with the Dreamers, but I also agree that I would say that giving citizenship to parents to citizen children, instead of separating them and allowing the children to go into the system. And we all know most of the children who go into the system do not turn out as well as a child would turn out if they had their families together. I would say it would cost less and be more productive to create productive citizens by keeping families united. So allowing for parents to become citizens of citizen children, they're already here, this is their home, to stay together would probably fix some of the bigger even issues in other places like the foster care system. And just think about your families. Are you willing to never see them again if you needed to move forward? Would you make that sacrifice? If you're able to and are against immigration, then I don't know. You have to put yourself in that situation and think, am I gonna say goodbye to my mother for forever? Even though I know that she's alive.
I think we're gonna go to our last question here.
Hello, my name is Cynthia Sarasua. Valeria, I wanna say thank you for coming, and I have family from and currently living in Silao, Guanajuato. I manage the International Learning Center, a part of Neighborhood House of Milwaukee, where we have been serving refugees and immigrants for about 40 years. I'm very proud to be part of the assimilation of these individuals, as well as helping them make new lives in our country. My question, Valeria, is how do you see your and your family's future?
I'm very optimistic, although I know that the political atmosphere is very tense right now, and there is a lot of racism and, you know, negativity that we experience. I feel that It'll be okay. I think we're gonna move forward as a country, and people are gonna start to wake up and realize that we cannot just send people back to a country that they haven't seen in forever. I do believe, and I see myself as a citizen in the near future. I'm very optimistic. If I was able to go to school without realizing or even knowing that DACA was coming, I mean, I would have never even, like, I just have to keep on moving forward like that. It'll come. It'll eventually come if we keep on pushing together and demanding for positive enforcement of laws and positive laws that keep us united and humane, treating everyone with humanity. I think we forget that we just almost are very insensitive to people who are even citizens here. And that's a reality, just because they made a mistake. And it's like the saying, you can do 99 things that are right, but if you do one thing, that's the one thing that people remember you by. But we have to start living by remembering the 99 things. We're all bound to make a mistake. We're all bound to make a mistake. And we cannot be held accountable for that one mistake for the rest of our lives.
Our Across the Divide panelists included Valeria Navarro-Villegas, who's an immigrant from the Mexican city of León and a very recent graduate of Marquette University. They also included Christopher Schmeling, the sheriff of Racine County since 2010, and Jose Olivieri, who is the founder and co-chair of Michael Best's immigration law practice. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Mary Spicuzza and Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke co-hosted the event, which was recorded in front of a studio audience at Carroll College in Waukesha. There is a link to photos and to the archived Facebook Live broadcast at WUWM.com. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in to Lake Effect today. Please be with us again tomorrow for another edition of the show from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.